Okay. Welcome, everybody. Can you all hear me? Thank you for coming to our reapplicant workshop. My name is Jillian Nickum. I'm the new Acting Assistant Dean of Admissions and Recruitment. I'm going to be speaking to you today both in French and English. So we won't be doing both for every slide. Some of the slides will be English, some will be French. I want to start off by explaining why we do this session. We started doing this a few years ago, and it seems to have been really effective for reapplicants. Through the years, we had a lot of meetings with reapplicants, and we were getting a lot of the same questions and going over the same points. So we figured that this was a better way to go about it. It was more transparent, and it would give everyone the information that they needed on the same grounds. We do also webcast this session, so it is being recorded. The podium and the slides will be posted. It's not recording the room, but if you, for that reason, I'm gonna focus on getting through the presentation, and we'll do Q&A at the end, and we'll ask that you write your questions on a sheet of paper. I believe Kelly probably explained this. So that the I'll read out your questions so that they'll be part of the webcast. So I introduced myself. We also have Kelly Cassidy here. She's the responsable des admissions. She runs the admissions office. And we have Connor McCorin. He is a student ambassador who is also was also and came into the program as a reapplicant. So he is going to speak with you at the beginning and tell you a little bit about his experience, and you'll have an opportunity to ask him some questions, and then I'll come back and go through the more detailed elements of the presentation. Also, we have brochures, which I believe Kelly probably gave to you already, as well as a survey that we ask that you complete at the end. It just helps us make sure that we're reaching people properly and getting information about who's here. So it really helps us improve what we're doing in the admissions office. So if you could please fill that out and give it to Kelly before you leave, that would be amazing. I'm just going to go through how this is going to work. So we've sort of done the introduction. I wanted to see if anyone has watched the webcast session from last year. Yes? Okay. We're going to go through, like I said, we're going to have Connor speak to us. Then we'll go through the reality of admissions at McGill and the competitiveness of the program. I'm going to go through a little bit of information around understanding what your refusal letter was saying, grasping your strengths and weaknesses, common pitfalls when reapplying, and useful tips in building a more competitive application. And then we'll move to the Q&A session. And we'll have a bit of Q&A, like I said, after Connor, so you get a chance to ask him some questions. So I guess at this point, I'll turn things over to you. And thank you, Connor.
Well, good evening, everyone. Once again, my name is Connor Macker, and I'm a second-year law student here at the faculty. I remember a summer day in 2013. I was sitting in a cafe with a friend, and I got a phone call. It was from the Office of Admissions here at McGill. And they said, Connor, we'd like to bring you in for an interview. When are you free? And I was just trembling with excitement. I'd always dreamed of attending McGill Law, and it seemed like I was so close. And I went in for my interview. I thought it went pretty well. But lo and behold, I wasn't admitted. And it was just bitterly disappointing, to be honest. And I think probably you guys can relate to that. But I come here today with a message of hope and of great optimism. Indeed, I'm here to tell you that an unsuccessful application does not preclude you from being admitted to this wonderful faculty of law. In fact, I would argue that your experience from your first application can very well play to your advantage. Admittedly, I'm not on the admissions committee. I don't know exactly how they assessed my file on the first time or the second time, but I can share my experience with you, and hopefully you can draw a few pieces of insight out as a result. So the first thing that I did in the interim between my first application and my second application was I took more time to reflect about some fundamental questions, namely, why law and why McGill? And I refined my answers to them. I would recommend that you do the same. So why law? Why does law interest you? What are you hoping to learn? Obviously, lawyers occupy a very important position in society. Once empowered with a legal toolkit, what kind of world do you hope to build with it? Second, why McGill? In particular, what appeals to you about McGill's transsystemic curriculum? Reflect about those questions. You might have heard about McGill's transsystemic education on the website, but I can assure you that it is not simply a buzzword. In fact, the curriculum here, in my experience, is very much shaped by this transsystemic approach. So once again, think about why a transsystemic approach would help you achieve your goals and how it would facilitate your development as a jurist broadly. In that pursuit, I would recommend that you read some of the papers written by McGill professors on that topic. McGill professors have been at the forefront of reinventing legal education, and in many ways, this program is very innovative. And once again, there are published academic articles on that topic, which I read in preparation for my personal statement the second time around, and I found it very helpful. So that's the first bit. The second thing, now this is kind of more for students who are just beginning their undergraduate education, who are, let's say, they applied after CEJEP, they didn't get in, and they're starting their undergrad. So one thing that I think I did well is I pursued my passions, and I excelled as a result. So I majored in political science. I was kind of unsure at the time. I was like, you know, if I don't get into law school, maybe I won't be very employable with this poli-sci degree. But in retrospect, it was the right decision because I was passionate about it. I enjoyed it. I did well as a result. Same thing with extracurriculars. Don't just do something because you think it's going to look good on your CV. Do something because you're passionate about it. And then I can almost guarantee you're going to rise into a leadership position. And I think that that looks great. And that's at least the way I approached it. And the third thing I would say is that I was pretty strategic. I think that knowing you want to go into law school, especially at the beginning of your undergraduate degree, is a huge advantage because you have a clear goal in mind. At that point, once you have that goal, you can outline a strategy to achieve that goal. Having already applied, you know more or less what you need. You need good grades. That's one component. The second component is you need people to provide you with references. And the third thing is at least a good CV, which basically means good extracurricular involvement. So you can be conscious in terms of how you're actually going about to build that good CV, to build good relationships with your professors, and to get good grades. I mean, in terms of my experience, I was very close with my professors. I used to go to office hours. I built strong relationships with them, and those are the people that I called on when I needed letters of reference. And I'm confident that they provided me with very strong letters, and that helped me, obviously, in my application. In terms of grades and extracurriculars, certainly, you know, I was conscious about how I wanted to build a good CV and how I wanted to be involved in extracurriculars, but I was also conscious of the fact that I needed to balance that with having good grades. So I always, yes, I was involved, but I never got involved to the extent that I was overextended and I was sacrificing on the grade front. I guess those are the tips that come to mind. I would just end by saying, you know, if your dream is to attend McGill Law, do not give up. You know, this isn't the end of the road. And I would also just offer a short quote by Benjamin Franklin, which is, energy and persistence conquer all things. With that being said, I welcome any questions you might have. I think my name is also on the first slide, so you can also contact me at connor.macron@mail.mcgill.ca, or you can add me on LinkedIn. I'd be more than happy to connect with you there as well. Okay. Sorry, I spoke really quickly. I got excited. So the first question I have is, did you apply directly out of SAGEP? If yes, what maturity did you gain with an undergrad? So the answer is yes, I applied directly out of SAGEP. I did 2 years of SAGEP and applied. In terms of the maturity I gained, without a doubt, I gained a lot. You know, obviously, like I mentioned at the beginning of my short speech, I really wanted to get in out of SAGEP. In retrospect, I think that doing an undergrad was a really great thing for me. I'm actually kind of glad that they didn't admit me right away in retrospect. Evidently, there's a million and one things that you can do during your undergrad. You can get involved in so many cool different activities. You can go on exchange, you can travel, you meet people. Sometimes people move out. That also kind of helps you grow up. You become independent. You get great professional experience. So, I mean, for me, I did all those things. I mean, I went on exchange to China. I worked for the federal government as an intern in the Parole Board of Canada. I worked as a research assistant researching cross-border terrorist financing. I was the business director of the Queen Solar Design Team. We built a fully self-sufficient solar home. And I also was the marketing manager for a $1.5 million business. So I'm not saying that to try and like, oh, like I'm so great. I'm just saying that there's a million and one things you can do. And undoubtedly, doing an undergrad, you will grow both academically and professionally. Any other questions? Please. No? Okay. So the second question is, what has been your biggest challenge as a McGill Law student, and how did you overcome it? Probably the biggest challenge is just the volume of work, especially in terms of reading. I think even our professors openly admit it at the beginning of our first year. They're like, listen, we give you so much reading, we don't actually expect you to do all of it. So I mean, I started my first year trying to read every page, every word of every page that they handed us, and that was incredibly challenging. It was absolutely exhausting. I would be up early in the morning, and I'd finish reading at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and it wasn't sustainable. So obviously there are coping strategies, which I, you know, employed to overcome that, namely having reading groups, you know, basically teaming up with other smart people in the faculty and doing reading groups together where you're both summarizing readings and then you cut down on how much you actually have to consume. And also just being a bit more strategic in what you're reading and how you're reading it. So like kind of understanding, okay, I don't actually need to read every line of this Supreme Court case. I can like read a summary, then figure out what bits are important, read those and like focus on those. Oftentimes cases actually, you know, even a long case, a 20-page case, there's like one or two paragraphs that are important, and that's from that. It's from there that we draw out the rule or the ratio, and that's kind of what you're going to end up be using on your exam. So definitely the volume of the work was a challenge, but there are definitely coping strategies that you learn and that you learn pretty quickly. Yeah. That's it. Did you have a question? No? Okay. All right, well, thank you for your time, and once again, don't hesitate to connect with me should you have any other questions. I wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you very much, Connor. Okay, so I'm going to dive in and start talking about the reality of admissions at McGill Law. So, maintenant nous sommes dans la salle du tribunal de l'école et on peut mettre 180 étudiants dans cette salle. Alors, si on prend tous les candidats qui ne sont pas qui n'ont pas de succès dans le processus, qui sont pas donné une offre, on peut remplir cette salle 5 fois. Alors, juste pour vous donner un peu d'idée de le niveau, le montant de place qu'on a, puis le montant de demande qu'on a, et c'est vraiment compétitif. Ça veut dire qu'il y a des très bons dossiers qui ne sont malheureusement pas acceptés. Pratiquement tous les dossiers sont bons, ont des bons aspects, ne sont pas mal au niveau même académique, mais il y a trop de demandes pour le montant de place. So I know that at some point, and it sounds like this happened to Connor, this might have been your experience with your application process to McGill Law, a disappointment with refusal, maybe confused, sad. We really appreciate when your politeness with our admissions office, it really helps us guide you through the process and guide you through your reapplicant process as well. But for now, I want to try and put some context onto the reality. So I just spoke a bit about the sheer volume of applications. We have over 1,000 refused candidates in every cycle. The applications to class size ratio is about 7 to 1. And due to lack of space, we do refuse many candidacies with positive elements. It's important to note that there are very few candidates who are not at all competitive. A lot of our files are from smart, hardworking students who are doing everything well. Just to take a quick poll of who's here, who was refused as a CEGEP candidate? Okay. As university? Mature? And advanced standing or transfer? Okay. Or refused after being on the waiting list, which could apply to all categories. Okay. So a reapplicant can mean a lot of things. It can be someone who's reapplying 3 years later after they were initially a CEGEP candidate and now they're a university candidate. It can be someone who is reapplying after 1 year of university, someone who's reapplying after getting a graduate level degree, and someone who came very close and was on the wait list. Un point important ou intéressant, c'est que dans la classe entrante cette année, 14,7% de la classe ont été les repostulants. Je vais juste prendre une pause ici pour expliquer que le mot repostulant, c'est un mot qu'on a inventé dans le bureau des admissions parce qu'on a trouvé qu'il n'y a pas vraiment une bonne traduction pour le mot reapplicant en français. Alors, c'est ça qu'on dit en français. Alors, c'est-à-dire que, oui, 11,2% des candidats étaient les repostulants, mais 14,7% de la classe entrant en été. Alors, ça veut dire que les repostulants ont d'habitude du succès en la deuxième fois. On a aussi, dans les types de repostulants, le cas d'un candidat qui avait été accepté, a décliné l'offre, puis a décidé de repostuler plus tard. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about understanding what your refusal letter was telling you. Trying to understand why of the refusal and analyzing the refusal. This is sort of the part where the workshop part of this workshop starts to kick in. I'm going to try and give you helpful, fact-based, transparent information, but it might not all be fun to hear, and you may have to take that away and sort of reflect on your previous application and try to take the information into put it into action. And be critical of your initial application, possibly. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about the holistic process of evaluation and the committee review process. So, the first thing to know is that the competitiveness of the program dictates that a long, hard, comparative process between files needs to take place. Which in the end ultimately may lead to many strong files being refused. Ultimately, you were refused because there were more stronger files in the pool for the number of spots we have. And if it's hard to understand why you were refused, that's why. It's not necessarily just weakness in the file, it's that there were more stronger files for the number of spots we have. So we have a faculty committee-based review process. It's all members of the faculty who do the who and the assistant dean who read the files and make decisions on the files. And in the holistic process, the committee takes every element of the file into consideration. So someone may be considered for admission, although he or she could have been refused on one ground alone, but the holistic process gives the committee the freedom to play around with the files and look into interesting features and strong potential to contribute in a file that may also have other weaknesses. The rest of a file can pull up the application even if one element is not necessarily competitive. And this can apply to grades, although still the grades are generally not that bad throughout the pool of candidates. The holistic approach doesn't mean that we favor that there's room to favor lower academic records over stronger ones. That seems obvious, but it's worth noting that the program's still very competitive on grades. The committee is not looking to admit anyone into the program who is not going to be able to have success here. And as Connor was attesting, there is quite a large volume of work. So we want to make sure that everyone who comes here is going to succeed. Sometimes people get the impression that because McGill considers more than grades, you have a higher chance of getting into McGill because of other strengths that are in your file than at other law schools. This is true and not true. We look at everything, yes, but academic strength is still very important in the file. We make a great effort to put grades that are not that are quantitatively less stellar in their proper context in the case of candidates who have faced barriers to higher education. The elements of the file that are assessed by the committee are your academic records, your LSAT, if you've taken one, your CV, the personal statement, the letters of recommendation, and extenuating circumstances, if that applies, as well as supporting documentation, which applies for only for some candidates, as well as evidence of linguistic abilities. We look at all those elements together to ensure that there's potential for academic success. And there are the, as well as the minimum of language capacity. There's no weight given to any one element, including grades. So, you know, grades aren't worth 50% of the assessment of your file or something like that. There's no cutoffs. So there's no minimum admissions, no minimum GPA for admissions, for example. The whole process is more fluid in practice, and based on my experience with the committee, the holistic approach to reviewing files can allow us to overlook one or two elements that are slightly weaker if the rest of the file is strong and relevant, but two or more weak elements is unlikely to be admitted. There is, however, a first screening based on linguistic abilities. So if a file clearly doesn't have English or French, and to be honest, it's more French than English that it's an issue at this point in the evaluation, the file will be refused whether or not it's strong or weak. So this can explain how somebody with a 95 cumulative average and a 175 LSAT can be refused from our program. If there's no evidence of French in the file, the file doesn't go further. Decisions are made by one or more committee members, each doing this holistic evaluation. So there's two levels. The first level is where files are circulated to the faculty committee, and each member assesses the file in relationship to the rest of the files that they have read. And then there's a final reader, which is the assistant dean, who reads the files in relationship to the entire pool of candidates. So those are the two sort of comparative levels of assessment. So when a file is refused, it can mean very rarely that you were really not competitive across the board, but more often it means that although there was a number of strong components, there were other candidates who were overall stronger for the number of spots available. Okay, so going through some of the reasons that could have been given in your refusal letter that you would have gotten on Minerva, the committee really makes an effort to give accurate and specific reasons in your letter. The sentences that are put in the letter depend on the predominant reasons that you were refused. So your letter can give you hints about how you should work to improve your file. So one of the reasons for refusal is that your file had positive elements but was overall not competitive. This is the most commonly used, and it means there was a mix of weaknesses and possibly strengths, but not one element was particularly uncompetitive. You may have come close on several elements, but not overall. Think back on your file, if you've got this reason in your letter, and assess the weaknesses and strengths. And through this workshop, we'll go through that process of assessing your weaknesses and strengths later on. Try to paint a picture of yourself. If you know you have strong grades, then try to identify where the other issues could have come from, if it was in the CV or the reference letters or personal statement. So another reason is the academic portion of the file was not competitive. This is used for sort of out of the ballpark cases of academic non-competitiveness. One of the things about your academic transcripts is that you have them forever, so it's very difficult to, you can't change them. So unless you have a really great LSAT score, and that's new, or a new degree, or extenuating circumstances that you maybe, to explain your academic record that you maybe didn't disclose the first time, you're unlikely to be admitted if you reapply. So there are ways to address this refusal, but your transcript will always be in your file. Insufficient French is another reason. This is an issue when the file is really great or maybe not, but if there was no French and your French has not been improved since the last time you applied, there's not much chance of you being admitted the second time around. Your undergraduate degree would not be finished by the time the program started. So although the minimum eligibility for the program is 60 undergraduate credits, the faculty has a preference for completed undergraduate degrees. So if your file may have been promising, but there would need to be very compelling reasons to admit a candidate who has not completed their undergraduate degree to be admitted under this cut with only 60 credits. Refused post-interview. So this is it's a reason that's rarely used. It's more actually a statement of fact. The interview may or may not have been determinative of your refusal. It is not usually used for SAGEP candidates who are usually encouraged to reapply after an undergraduate degree. It could also mean that the interview, it could mean the interview was determinative or not, but that reason is just sort of letting you know that you've been refused post-interview, not that the interview necessarily led to you not being accepted. Encouraged to reapply means there are many good elements, but it's just borderline and not quite waitlist potential. It may also be that something needs to be fixed, like the LSAT score or the level of French. Just a note for waitlisted applicants whose letters don't offer reasons other than space in the class, you should consider yourselves encouraged to reapply. Because if you've made it to the wait list, it's an indication that your file was close. Okay, so let's talk a bit about understanding how to identify your strengths and weaknesses. This is sort of the part where you need to be reflective on about your file and what you can do to improve it and where you think it may have not been strong enough. Look objectively at your letter in your past application, and you may have already have a good idea of what you need to work on. Just to give some context of why we are demanding on the academic front, the average course load in the program is 15 to 18 credits, and as Connor was telling us, there's a lot of reading, and it's hard to stay on top of all the readings. Because it's so competitive, we have a lot of bright, hardworking students here, and even though a 75% cumulative GPA out of your undergraduate is not bad at all, the faculty is quite, they're insistent on maintaining high academic standards to make sure that everyone who is admitted meets success. We do have the holistic approach, and there's no formula for how people get admitted, so we do have a range which fluctuates slightly from year to year. So the entering averages of the class for this year was 84.4% for university candidates, a 161 LSAT for those who took the LSAT, and an R score of 33.9 and 90.8% for CEGEP candidates. So those are averages, but I'll give you a little more context and talk about the range. So for the range of university candidates, the lowest admit in the last cycle was a 71% cumulative grade point average, and the highest was a 99%. For CEGEP, the lowest was a 31.9 R score, the highest was a 36.9. The lowest LSAT was 146. But to contextualize the range a little bit as well, the 25th percentile of admits is already at 82%, 33.13 R score, and 159 LSAT. So this means there's only 24% of the class that has less than those, so less than an 82%, less than a 33 R score, and less than a 159 LSAT. So that sort of gives a sense of the exceptions we make in the context of academic competitiveness. Usually there's less than 10 admits below 78%. In 2017, it was actually 7 admits that were below 78%, and 12 which were below 80%, which is still a high B+. University candidates who did go to CEGEP, don't worry too much about this, the weight that your CEGEP grades here. There's much less weight given to university candidates with CEGEP on the CEGEP grades for university candidates. If you have done an undergraduate degree, the weight is really given to your undergraduate GPA more than your CEGEP grades. So if you have these types of grades in the range of our admits, it's also useful to know that the committee really reads the entire transcript. They look for so-called easy courses, or they look at the level of progression in the curriculum. So if there's a lot of 200-level classes and hardly any 400-level classes, that's something the committee's probably going to notice. They'll also use their understanding of the rigor of the program. And if class averages are provided on the transcript, they'll compare the grade that the applicant got with the class averages to get a sense of where that applicant sat in that class. Okay. On va parler un peu de les documents qui sont au-delà du dossier scolaire, qui sont aussi très importants. Si vous avez d'excellentes notes et vous avez tout de même été refusé, voici sur quoi vous devez travailler. Ça, c'est légèrement plus facile parce que c'est pas fixé dans le passé. Alors, le premier élément, c'est le CV. On cherche dans un CV pour voir est-ce que l'engagement était passif ou est-ce que cette candidat a pris un rôle de leadership lors des clubs d'étudiantes ou les emplois. On regarde pour la profondeur de l'implication. Alors, si tu es impliqué dans une ou deux activités, mais mais très impliqué, impliqué profondément dans ces activités. C'est plus compétitif que plusieurs activités au niveau passif. Et plusieurs combinaisons peuvent être gagnantes. Alors, c'est-à-dire, si tu travailles, tu es bénévolat, tu es engagé dans les sports ou la musique, c'est pas juste une chose qui fait un bon CV. C'est pas juste les activités à l'école ou quoi que ce soit. C'est plutôt comme l'ensemble du CV. Un dossier qui est moins compétitif, c'est un CV, c'est un qui a moins rien sauf les études. Alors, tu as les bonnes notes ou les notes moyennes et un emploi d'été, mais pas d'engagement pendant l'année scolaire du tout. Ça, c'est moins compétitif au niveau du CV. On a la lettre de présentation personnelle. Alors, c'est important de relire la lettre et d'assurez-vous que vous avez répondu aux trois questions qu'on demande. Alors, est-ce que vous avez répondu avec suffisamment de profondeur ou est-ce que la lettre effleure seulement les questions? Alors, comme Connor nous a expliqué, il faut expliquer pourquoi le droit, prendre un exercice, engager dans un exercice de réflexion et de nous convaincre pourquoi vous aimeriez faire vos études ici à McGill. Et je crois que l'approche que Connor a pris, c'est très intéressant. Il a vraiment fait ses recherches à propos de comment fonctionne le programme du point de vue des profs ici. Alors ça, c'est une approche très intéressante. Une autre approche sera de parler aux étudiants qui sont ici ou vous pouvez prendre une belle idée, je crois, en lisant notre site web aussi. Alors, la lettre de présentation personnelle aide le comité des admissions à comprendre les facteurs qui vous incitent à poursuivre une formation juridique, les raisons qui motivent votre désir pour les études en droit, ainsi que l'intérêt que vous portez à notre programme spécifiquement. L'essai permet aux membres du comité des admissions d'évaluer votre qualité d'écriture. Alors, c'est important d'assurer que c'est bien écrit, ainsi que votre capacité à vous exprimer clairement à l'écrit, que ce soit en anglais ou en français ou les deux. Et à travers de cet essai, nous cherchons à évaluer votre niveau de maturité et de jugement. Alors, c'est vraiment un bon moment de réfléchir sur vous-même, qu'est-ce que vous aimeriez faire avec vos études en droit et pourquoi vous aimeriez étudier ici à McGill. Les lettres de recommandation. Alors, la plupart du temps, ces lettres sont positives. Si une lettre de référence, une lettre de recommandation n'est pas positive, c'est vraiment un grave problème. Et je crois que la plupart du temps, vous ne voyez pas les lettres, sont envoyées directement à nous. Alors, si le prof ou la personne à qui tu as demandé une lettre n'a pas donné une copie à toi, c'est impossible de savoir qu'est-ce qui est dans la lettre. Alors, s'il y a dans une lettre, ça indique les problèmes avec les dates limites ou les problèmes avec les communications, c'est un problème pour le dossier. Mais même si les lettres sont positives, qui la plupart du temps ils sont, ils peuvent être moins compétitifs s'ils semblent être coupés-collés ou non spécifiques, ou s'ils parlent uniquement des qualités personnelles. Alors, si ça dit que vous êtes respectueuse, que vous posez des questions pertinentes, que vous êtes impliquée à l'extérieur de l'école, ce sont des éléments, des commentaires positifs, mais ils sont plutôt hors sujet. On cherche les commentaires sur la qualité des interventions, la qualité de la recherche, de la rédaction, de l'intelligence, de curiosité académique. Si la lettre de référence ne mentionne pas ces choses, ça peut être positif, mais pas nécessairement concurrentiel et pas très distinctif. Encore une fois, les commentaires de Connor sont bons dans ce contexte parce qu'il a parlé il a fait un effort de connaître ses profs. Alors, on sait dans ce cas, les profs qui nous connaissent bien, qui connaissent notre intelligence, notre engagement, et c'est ces profs-là qui sont peut-être les bons à demander pour les lettres de recommandation. Alors, les aptitudes linguistiques. Ça, c'est pas concurrentiel de même sens que les aptitudes académiques. Si vous êtes complètement bilingue, c'est pas plus compétitif que d'avoir les aptitudes linguistiques de base pour l'éligibilité au programme. Alors, on veut s'assurer qu'il y a le niveau qu'on a besoin, puis au-delà de ça, la distinction se fait sur les autres facteurs. Alors, c'est une qualité qui est nécessaire, mais pas compétitif au même niveau que les autres éléments du dossier. Et les circonstances atténuantes. Alors, ceci entre en ligne de compte dans l'évaluation de dossiers scolaires, éventuellement du CV. Les circonstances atténuantes peuvent avoir un moindre impact s'ils ne sont pas supportés par des preuves externes ou le cas échéant. Mais elles sont toujours prises en considération. Le comité donne beaucoup de bénéfices de doute s'il y avait quelque chose qui s'est passé, mais vous n'avez pas parlé dans votre demande. Ça peut répondre aux questions si vous expliquez. Alors, on ne veut pas laisser le comité de prendre ses propres conclusions autour de votre dossier. S'il y a une explication pour un semestre où vous n'avez pas réussi des bonnes notes ou un CV qui n'est pas vraiment compétitif, c'est mieux d'expliquer pourquoi. OK. So, I'm going to move next to moving past the reasons for refusal and looking to some of the common pitfalls we find in the reapplication itself. So the two most common pitfalls are reapplying without hardly changing anything in your file, and improving on your strengths instead of your weaknesses. So if you reapply without hardly changing anything, you are very likely to be refused again, unless you are on the wait list until the very end, and even then, reapplying is not just waiting for your luck to turn or waiting for the pool to become less competitive, because the pool won't become less competitive. If it's a second case where you improve on your strengths instead of your weaknesses, you're likely to be refused again because your weaknesses need to be addressed. And the committee won't get past a major weakness. There's a natural tendency to focus on what you're good at, but you need to work on the file, on the weaknesses of the file, even if it's more painful to do so. Il y a les autres pièges. Les aptitudes linguistiques ne sont inchangées. Alors, c'est pas facile de changer vos aptitudes linguistiques. C'est difficile à apprendre une autre langue, mais c'est réalisable. Alors, si c'est ça qui n'est pas concurrentiel dans le dossier, il faut la redresser. Et un autre piège, c'est si vous parlez dans l'essai personnel. Le fait de parler de refus et du chemin parcouru depuis, mais ne répond pas aux trois questions qu'on vous demande dans la lettre. Un autre piège, c'est de brûler les ponts. La faculté essaie d'éviter d'admettre les candidats qui seraient toxiques à la communauté des professeurs et des étudiants. Alors, nous comprenons bien le stéréotype des avocats qu'ils aiment argumenter et combattre pour ce qu'il perçoit comme une injustice, mais une bonne juriste le fait avec respect, intégrité et intelligence. Alors, je me soupçonne, si vous êtes tous ici, c'est parce que vous êtes ouverts d'esprit et vraiment vous prenez ce processus au sérieux. Alors, c'est juste à être conscient que toutes les interactions avec les membres du faculté et le staff ici, sont importants. Okay, so I'm going to go through some useful tips for building a more competitive application. One is avoiding the common pitfalls, which I just went over, and the other is being open, lucid, and adaptable, and thinking critically about your past application and how you could improve it. So we talked about this a little bit, but I'll go through it again, whether or not you can redress your lack of academic competitiveness. So the LSAT is one way to do that. If you didn't write it the first time, or if you did write it and you weren't happy with your result, or you think that your result on the LSAT could be one of the reasons your file is not competitive, rewriting it can, and if you get a better score, can improve your file. If you were an undergraduate candidate pursuing a master's degree, it could be a way to show an improvement in your academic grade, in your academic standing. But I would only really recommend doing that if that's something that you really want to do anyway. It's difficult to be successful in a graduate program if it's a means to an end, reapplying to law school. If you are were a SAGEP candidate who was refused, obviously doing an undergraduate degree and a complete undergraduate degree rather than 60 credits is another way to address lack of academic competitiveness. If your grades were strong enough to be admitted to a law school in Canada, but you were refused from here, another way is to start your studies at the school where you were admitted. And then to apply to McGill as a transfer student. At least this gets you going closer to your goal. And if you do very well in law school at another Canadian law school, those grades in first year will be, if they're strong, will be quite impactful in the committee review, because it shows that you can handle a law school curriculum and that you will have you're likely to have academic success in the program here. Another thing that's important to do is to check our instructions every year. So you can't presume that nothing has changed since you last applied. So we had changes recently in terms of the length of the CV this year we have a slightly different process for applications for Indigenous applicants. And some other things that can be helpful to know: your reference letters should really be from academic sources, if possible. Sometimes you know one prof really well, and you have an employer who you know really well. That can be an okay combination, but it's better to have two profs that you think know you well to write your letters of recommendation. So it's not a requirement that they both be academic, but it's really better if they are. Okay, so what goes into a new application? If it's been less than 3 years since you last applied, your first application is still in our archives. So the committee will look at the new application, but they will also have the old one, and they may refer to that in part if they feel they want to check that out. They'll have access to it. The committee likes to get a sense of the evolution of the file, so if you're a reapplicant, they might want to see what has changed, what did you do to address your refusal in your file. They will also look at your reasons for refusal, and there are lots of reapplicants, so having your first file be accessible to the committee is not really anything to be worried about. It's just letting you know that they do have access to it so that you're aware. If you applied more than 3 years ago, the file is shredded, so you will need new everything. So when you're applying, doing your reapplication. You need a new CV. You'll need a new personal statement. And the new personal statement must stand alone. So even though the committee has access to your previous file, don't assume that they're going to read that to get a picture of why you're reapplying and what has happened since you last applied. Really, the new personal statement has to stand on its own. We explained this at the beginning. That's okay. No. We are going to take questions at the end. And if you can write them down, then we can read them into the microphone. No, it's no problem. You need a new CV, new personal statement, and the transcripts and reference letters, it depends. If the old ones were not final, then you would need to submit your final transcripts from that degree program. And any other new degrees or that you pursued, you would need to provide the transcripts for anything new. If you had written an LSAT and that's new, you need to provide those as well. For reference letters, you are only allowed to submit two reference letters. You can keep the two old ones that were in your first file. But you can also substitute them for new ones. So if you're concerned that your reference letters could have been the cause of weakness in your file, you might want to think about getting new ones sent in. And you can just send in one and replace one instead of both. And overall, not just on the personal statement, but a new application must stand on its own merits in totality. So again, don't assume that the committee will read your previous application. Okay, so now we will start taking some questions. If we can focus on questions for reapplicants versus general admission, that would be great. So thank you for listening, and I look forward to your questions. Okay, so the first question is, does part-time work and internships count toward extracurricular activity? Yes. So in your CV, there can be lots of things that go into a strong CV. It can be work experience, it can be internships, it can be extracurriculars. It's really a chance for you to show everything that you have done outside of your academic transcript. So don't feel like your CV is going to need to have a lot of extracurriculars. If you were involved in things outside of school, that can make a strong CV as well. So it's a wide range of activities that can make a strong CV. One of the things we're looking for in a CV is strength of leadership and involvement, but it's also the ability to be able to balance studying with other activities too. So keep that in mind as well. Okay, next question is, if the application was made less than 3 years ago, do we have to submit a new all? On the level of transcripts, you need to resubmit your transcripts if the first time you applied your transcripts were not final. And you need to submit transcripts for anything new that you did since you last applied. So if you got a master's degree or you did an LSAT, you need to submit your transcripts for that. For your CV and your personal statement, there's an assumption that those are going to have changed. So you have to submit new CV and new personal statement. And on the reference letters, you can submit new ones if you feel like the reference letters could have been what caused your file to be less than competitive the first time around. And also, I failed to mention this before, but if there were extenuating circumstances that you feel might be relevant to the assessment of your file that you didn't include the first time around, you may want to think about providing a letter of extenuating circumstances then. Okay. So, should we add results of French exams? No. We don't specifically ask for results of French exams. It's we determine the level of French from your undergraduate transcript and other things you've studied, as well as if you've done part of your application in French, that can give us an indication. Or if you've told us where you've learned French, if it was not in the university context, so if it's not something that's on your transcript, but you've explained where you have your French from, these are all ways that we assess French in the file. Did I miss anything? Right, CV is another place where you can show your French, your level of French. If you worked in a French workplace, that can be relevant, and there's other things that could go on your CV to show that as well. Next question. If waitlisted was done more than a year ago, is it still possible or recommended to apply? Yes, I think being waitlisted, so if you were waitlisted but it wasn't, say, in April of this year, but you're looking to reapply this fall, but you're waitlisted several years ago, I mean, I think being waitlisted shows that your file was very close. So it's always worth reapplying if you're still interested in the program, and it doesn't matter how long ago you were waitlisted. Hopefully you've done things, if it's been more than 6 months since you were waitlisted but were not admitted, hopefully it just gives an avenue for your file to be even stronger because you've had more time to improve the file. And how can I know my weaknesses if I was on the waiting list? I think, going through some of the pitfalls and the ways that the file is assessed and thinking critically of your file in light of that, that's really the best approach. Again, if you were waitlisted, it means you got very close. So it may just be a matter of rethinking your personal statement and trying to be, really more convincing about what motivates you to study at McGill and why you're interested in law, and trying to find a way to make yourself stand out. So just a little more. I think knowing your weaknesses is the same process for any reapplicant, really, even if you're waitlisted. It's still a good idea to do that assessment to make sure that you get in without being waitlisted the next time around. If a new personal statement should stand on its own, is it bad to be repetitive? For example, focusing on the same answers to questions like why McGill in terms of the old one? That's a good question. So if your answer hasn't changed much since the last application, then you don't want to make things up just to create a different personal statement. But it may be that you're able to go deeper into that answer, or to do more research, or to think more, reflect more on the reason and go into more depth. So it's not bad to be repetitive. I'd say even though the committee has access to your first personal statement and they can read it, you can still have the same reasons, but I think you want to take a new start at the whole process. If your personal statement looks the same, the opening paragraph is the same, for example, or much of it seems like there's no change, like that's not going to be stronger. It's okay to still have the same reasons, but I think you want to reimagine how you're going to present them and try and go in more depth. If reference letters are replaced with the old ones, will the old ones still be taken into consideration? So, no. If you have reference letter A and reference letter B, and you want to replace reference letter A with a new one, being reference letter C, reference letter A will not be in your new file. It'll be replaced with the new one. It will be in your old file. Right, so your initial reference letter will be in the old file, but in the new one there will just be two, and you can select which one you want to remove and have replaced. Will working in Montreal be a sufficient indication of French ability, or should we explicitly mention it in the CV or in the personal statement? It's always a good idea to specifically mention how you learned French. It just makes it easier and doesn't allow the committee to draw their own conclusions. Okay. I understand that the personal statement must be different from the previously submitted. However, I have been a lawyer for a decade. The reasons why law, why me, and why McGill remain the same. Quand vous avez dit qu'on doit écrire une lettre de présentation nouvelle, comment on pourrait faire cela? Changer la langue est-il une bonne idée? Oui, vous pouvez changer la langue, mais je crois que la chose qui est plus importante, c'est de vraiment aller en profondeur ou d'être certaine que vous avez bien répondu, que vous êtes convaincante, que vous êtes que la lettre que ça raconte une histoire qui est différente des autres candidats dans le groupe. Et il se peut que au niveau de lettre de présentation personnelle, c'est pas le problème dans le dossier, ça peut être quelque chose d'autre. Alors si vous croyez que la lettre c'est vraiment fort, peut-être il faut regarder dans les autres aspects du dossier et réfléchir si est-ce que cet autre élément peut être mieux. Qu'est-ce que je peux faire pour améliorer cet aspect du dossier? On the website, it says that there is a limited number of places available for advanced standing category. Could you please clarify this number? How many were accepted at the last applicant pool? I'm going to turn that to Kelly.
So it is just as competitive for advanced standing applicants as it is for regular university applicants. So the average admit GPA for advanced standing applicants is still 85%, 3.8 on a 4.0 scale, in their law courses, not just their undergrad. So it becomes that much more competitive on the grades front from that standpoint. We don't receive that many applications from advanced standing applicants. We get, I would say probably around 20-ish applications. And every year it could depend. We might admit three or four, we might admit none, we might admit one or two. So it really depends on the pool. It's true, the website does say that space is limited. There's not a specific number of places. We don't have a quota that we're looking to fill. It just means to say that there are far fewer advanced standing applicants in the class. Does that answer the question?
I think so. If you feel that we haven't answered your question adequately, feel free to ask again or ask in a different way or seek more information. Okay, is our previous application consulted to any extent? If yes, would it be best to remain consistent in our next application? For example, use the same reference, similar tone and letter of intent. So I kind of went over this in some of the earlier answers, but I think you want your new application to A, stand on its own, but B, probably you need to try to change it. First of all, it wasn't competitive the first time around, so you want to try and make sure that you address that and work to make it more competitive. But there's also probably been some time that has gone by since your first application, and in that time, what have you done? How has that changed you? How has that made you a better candidate? And at the level of your motivations for studying law, those may have changed too or become more nuanced or more informed. So I think it's always important to really try and focus in on those things to make your file stronger and not just repeat the same things that were in the first time around. Does the time of year that you hear from the admissions office, is it an indication of anything? Not necessarily. We work through over 1,000 files, and sometimes we get to files later in the process. They also go through a committee process where they are circulated to committee and then they come back to the assistant dean. It's not necessarily an indication of anything. We do try to make our offers to the strongest candidates as quickly as we can after the application deadline. on the assumption that those candidates are going to be getting offers from other other faculties. But beyond that, there's not really we're not trying to meet specific deadlines in the process. We're trying to get as many offers out as quickly as we can. So that's what we're working. That's what we're working on in, with our process. When you email the admissions office with questions, is that reflected in your file? They don't become part of the file. No. So your questions are just in the admissions office. The documents that go into your file are the documents that we ask for. And how do you change or substitute a reference letter? By email. So you'd send a new one, or the new referee would send the new reference letter, and the candidate lets you know which one. Let's the admissions office know. You want to answer that?
Alors, si vous voulez faire un substitut de vos lettres de recommandation, vous avez tout simplement envoyé un courriel à admissions.law@mcgill.ca, nous indiquant lequel des répondants vous voulez enlever et lequel vous voulez ajouter. Et puis, on va faire ça manuellement. Et quand nous recevons la lettre du nouveau répondant, ou si jamais on l'a déjà, mais c'est juste pas dans votre dossier parce que c'était pas un répondant dont vous avez mis dans votre demande, on va faire l'ajustement. Alors, ça prend une couple de jours, mais c'est quand même assez vite. Et vous avez l'option de faire un substitut jusqu'à la date limite pour les documents justificatifs. Alors, vous avez jusqu'au 8 novembre ou 7 mars. Yes. No, if you don't switch out your referees by the deadline, it'll show that you don't have your reference letters in on time and your file will be canceled. So make sure that you submit your documents on time. Well, okay, so nuancing what Jillian mentioned, because if you're a reapplicant and you want to use the same reference letters, you need to name the same two referees in your application. It's not an automatic thing that your references will roll over. If you name two different people, then we're going to wait for letters from those two people. If you name the same two people in your second application, we will manually take last year's reference letters or, you know, the last application reference letters, and we'll roll them forward. But you have to still tell us who your referees are. And if it so happens that you're using the same two referees, but you're asking them for new letters, which is something that does happen, then we will simply swap them back out again with the same person's reference letter. But if you don't, to go back, if you do want to make a substitution and you've asked someone to send us a letter, but you've never told us that you want to substitute, that it'll show as if we've never received a letter, so that's an important thing, because then your file risks being canceled. Yep. Documents can always be sent by mail. Reference letters really should be sent by email. It's preferable. If they come in before you change referees, we have a different folder that we'll put them in while they wait for a file to be attached to.
Thanks for that clarification on the reference letter process, Kelly. Okay, so my next question is, last year McGill told me to work on my French skills after a phone interview and apply again this year. I've already taken McGill's School of Continuing Studies Advanced French course before the interview, before the interview, but not sure what else I should do to prove to McGill I've been working on my French. I want to display my commitment to addressing this weakness. Sorry, I just need to reread this again quickly. I guess taking additional French courses is an easy way to show the committee that you've been working on this, showing on your CV some involvement in an activity or an employment context that would require French. If you don't have those, and explaining in your in your application how you have improved your French since your the last time you applied, and hoping that you get another interview or another call as a last case or worst case scenario, and that you do well enough on that interview to be given an offer. So any way that you can show that you've made improvements to your French will be assessed in the file. So another question is on this one is, last application cycle, I didn't take the LSAT, but this session I took it to apply to other schools. How much weight will it have? So the LSAT, if you do take it, it is part of your file, and it is weighed alongside the rest of your transcripts, and it becomes an important part of the academic assessment of the file. So we sort of went through some of the stats around the averages of this year's incoming class on the LSAT. Was 160 was the average, with a low of 146, which is rare for an admitted candidate. If you aren't in that range, if you're not around, in the 150s at least, you are going to want to think about other ways to make your file stand out, because the LSAT will become part of the transcripts that are assessed. Okay, next one. I was on the wait list up until 2 days ago. Was my condition of acceptance based on if anyone dropped out in the first week? People don't drop out in the first week. Sometimes people don't arrive. Okay. I'm Kelly. Can you answer that question, or is there an answer for that question?
It's really unfortunate. We do keep a very, very small number of people on the wait list up until 2 days ago. Or it was Monday, I think, was the last day where the last of the waitlist candidates were refused. It really is because since in-person registration, we did have three people withdraw from the program. So we try to get people in the seats as much as possible. And that's why the waitlist lasts as long as it does. So you were obviously exceptional files, and there weren't very many people who had to hold on that long. There's no real answer. It's a strong waitlist file.
Thank you. Okay, what happens if in the application you mention that you will be doing the LSAT but end up changing your mind because you are not applying to other English schools? You would need to send the admissions office an email letting them know you've decided not to write it so that they can make a change to the file, so we're not waiting for your transcript in order for the file to become complete. So letting the admissions office know would be essential in that case so that they're to avoid your file being canceled. Right, and so Kelly says sometimes we would need proof that you've decided to withdraw from taking the LSAT in your file. What is the approximate number or percentage of students who took the LSAT for this year's admissions? So for our webcast, I'll repeat that. About 50 to 60% of undergraduate applicants have the LSAT in their file. In the class. Is it possible to change the name of the referee even if the admissions file has been created? So it would be possible to change the name of the referee up until the deadline, and to accept a new letter from a new referee up until the deadline for supporting documents. How are mature students evaluated differently? There's obviously with mature students, they have more life experience. Maybe they've gone and had a career in a field and then decided that they want to study law. It may be that sometimes the undergraduate academic standing, if it is, from several years ago or a decade ago, but this person has had quite an impressive career, it may not be as weighty in the consideration. Also, mature students are often interviewed before admission. Is that not anymore? Okay, so I think that there is just a wider context for assessing the file of mature candidates, looking more into the life experience that they've had since their undergraduate studies. Yes, Kelly, please add something.
Sorry, I just wanted to add that academically, mature candidates are as strong as university applicants, even though their degrees were sometimes taken a while back. It is very exceptional that someone's work experience and life experiences and maturity that they bring would still outshine to a great extent a weak academic performance when they were in their undergraduate degree.
Is there any other questions? If there was no mention of French in our rejection letter, can we assume that our French level is acceptable? Yes, so you can assume it was. Your file would have gone through, it passed through that first triage where we're assessing linguistic abilities before the file goes further. So if you got a different letter, a different reason for your refusal, you can assume that your French is sufficient. Although there are files where there appears to be enough French and the file goes through to committee and we decide to still give a call to the candidate before sending an offer to make sure that the French level is high enough. So even though you can assume that it went through the process after the assessment of linguistic abilities, I guess it's not, you want to still make sure that your French is going to be adequate if you get a phone call from the assistant dean or someone in the admissions office to test your French. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be safe for an admit. It just means that you've gotten through the first triage the first time you applied. About to test their French? Well, we do sometimes when we're not sure about the level of French in a file, we will do a call to test the level of French. Someone from the admissions office or the assistant dean can call any time to ask you any question about your file, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you're close to getting an offer or getting a refusal. Or it could mean we need more information. It could be that we're trying to test your French. It could be to talk to you about something more in your file because something wasn't quite clear. So there could be kind of all kinds of reasons why you'd get a call, and none of them are really indicative of where you are in the process or what your chances of getting an offer. Any other questions? Okay, so the question is, what weight is given to master graduate studies? So the undergraduate grade point, the cumulative undergraduate grade point average is what is sort of recorded for statistics purposes in terms of the entering class. All of your transcripts are assessed for strength and competitiveness. The undergraduate transcript is given a little bit more weight because it runs more in parallel to sort of the learning curve that would be similar to coming into first-year law school as opposed to graduate studies, which it may be in an area where you've already got some knowledge and some expertise, you're doing higher-level research. So the undergraduate transcript is probably given slightly more weight, although the graduate transcript is definitely looked at. The committee looks at all the transcripts and assesses them for their competitiveness there. Okay, there's no other questions. I want to say thank you all very much for coming and for your excellent questions, and remind you to please fill out the survey. Thank you for your patience and for Kelly's help. Although I have been the Assistant Dean of Admissions before, it was 2 years ago, and I've not even started again. So this was my first time doing anything in 2 years, so apologies for not knowing some of the specifics, but thanks to Kelly for knowing everything. So thanks so much.